Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined this week for this very special episode to talk about Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist by my favorite concert buddy, Rob DiCristino. Welcome back, Rob.
Patrick, I found a wet nap in my pocket because I don't ever wash my pants. I like to keep the night on them.
Thank you everyone once again who participated in F This Movie Fest. Thank you, Rob, for making the trip all the way out to Chicago to be here and hang with us in person.
It's my honor as always, buddy.
It was a lot of fun. Hopefully you guys heard the podcast. I apologize for being more or less incoherent for most of the podcast, but thankfully I was surrounded by people who know what they're doing and were able to pick up the slack.
No, it was great. It's great as always. And I think the podcast actually turned out better than you think it did. I thought it was really fun and we got a lot of positive feedback on it. So
yay. It's always,
I would like definitely to figure out the video portion though. Cause a couple people asked me why we didn't do the video this year. Obviously because it's incredibly difficult and Erica ends up having to hold the phone and right. It's really irritating, but, I'm going to figure something out for next year. I'm going to start working on it now.
All right.
Hopefully be ready by now.
A series of cameras are being installed in my basement as we speak.
You're not supposed to know about them.
Oh, shit. All right. We're going to be talking about Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, the movie that everyone has been clamoring for a podcast about.
Look, Patrick, you and I, we bring the hits, okay?
I'll tell you what, man. We did Josie and the Pussycats, and... people really responded to that. Like that was actually very, very popular. So maybe this also has a similar cult audience, though I kind of think maybe not.
Or we're creating that cult audience.
I like where your head's at.
Our tastemakers. We did also get a shout out on Twitter from the co-director of Josie and the Pussycats.
That's right.
So, that's always cutting edge, Patrick. We're on the cutting
That's always a thing where, like, I immediately then feel like I need to go back and listen. Like, everything we said was pretty positive, right? We didn't say, man, everything about this movie is good except for anything that Harry Alfont contributed. Rob, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, speaking of which, I did recently go to the movies with a bunch of friends, some pretty handsome and attractive people, to see Captain Marvel.
That's right.
Which is what we did.
All the way to Chicago to see Captain Marvel.
Well, you have the best IMAX screens.
It's pretty good.
Friday before at this movie fest, a bunch of us went out and we saw Captain Marvel, sure. we talked a little bit about it. Look, I mean, there's no, you know, the theater we went to was packed. It was packed with people of all ages. There were tons of kids there. You brought Rosie and Charlie came with us, and you mentioned afterwards that this was basically the only Marvel movie that Rosie has really expressed an interest in seeing, right?
Yes. I think
which is there.
Although
it is.
She did, to be fair, sleep through most of it.
Well, it's got second act problems, but the, that in itself is worthy enough. I mean, after that, it really doesn't matter because that's obviously what matters when we talk about this sort of next phase of Marvel where they're, you know, getting to the point of like, hey, by the way, we'll put a woman in these movies or, you know, a person of color. But no, I Captain Marvel was fine. I thought it was clunky, storytelling wise. I had to kind of go back and reread the Wikipedia page to kind of remember what happened in it. I think Samuel L. Jackson is having fun. I think there are parts of it that are kind of flat and feel kind of cheap. But I had the similar thing with Doctor Strange where I was like, I don't know if I really like the Doctor Strange movie. But when I saw Doctor Strange in Avengers Infinity War, I was like, oh, you know what? No, I do like him. So I have a feeling that when I watched the Endgame trailer this week and you see Captain Marvel show up at the end, I was like, oh, that's right. I'll like her, you know, because, you know, I'll like her in the group with everyone else. And which I think is kind of what a lot of these Marvel movies, I know I'm not the first person to say this, but a lot of this newer phase of Marvel movie origin stories, you know, your Ant-Mans and stuff, they're kind of introducing them to say, okay, here you go. Here's, you know, here's this person. He'll be with them next time, you know? So overall, I didn't love Captain Marvel. It's middle tier for me, but I love Brie Larson. I think it was fun. And I obviously like that this new character is in the Marvel Universe.
Do you think it's weird at all, though, that like they spent, you know, conceivably $150 to $250 million to make a two-hour movie that exists as the trailer for her appearance in another trailer?
It is.
Because it really is. We were talking about it the next day that, like, yeah, these movies kind of exist to introduce you to, here's so-and-so, so now when they show up in future movies, you'll be happy to see them.
When you think about these movies as comic books, you know, that's not uncommon. Here we're introducing this character and, you know, they'll have their own series soon or so on and so forth. And, I don't know. I don't want to shit on it too much because obviously I like what these guys are doing, but.
I probably liked it a little bit more than you. I liked it enough. You know, I have the same reaction to a lot of these movies, which is like, I'm pretty entertained when they're on. And then, I don't think about them much and very rarely want to revisit them, even the ones that I walk away saying, boy, I really liked that, you know, Captain America, the Winter Soldier. I remember leaving and being like, that was really good. Yeah, that was like better than a lot of these other movies. And I've revisited it maybe one time, maybe, probably in the run up to Infinity War, because I just, for whatever reason, I like these characters. I get excited when these movies come out. I used to read comic books. I mean, I feel like I'm the audience for these movies, and yet it's just not a world I care to like keep going back to for whatever reason. I don't know why.
And, you know, to be fair, I want to be clear. There are things in Captain Marvel I really like. I think there's a moment between her and Jude Law near the end, which, you know, not to spoil for anybody, but she kind of has a moment that I think is going to be quoted quite a bit over the next year, if not more. And that was a stand up and cheer moment for sure. I think the movie stumbles to get to it, but I think once it gets to it, you're like, okay, that was badass. And that is going to be on t-shirts, you know? And that's the movie's thesis. And that it was really great. So that moment was really good. And, I actually did go back and on my list here, I did go back and rewatch a couple random Marvel movies. I rewatched Ant-Man and the Wasp. I texted you and Adam the other night. I was like, this movie was good. I don't know if we really noticed this one enough. I really like Evangeline Lilly, and the movie is solid. And I rewatched Captain America: The Winter Soldier, and like you mentioned, and I think that might be my favorite one. It's that whole '70s sort of paranoid thriller thing, and
it's pretty good.
It's got the most, for some reason, the action in that movie is the most like kind of like frenetic and like heavy that it's been. Like it feels like there's actual weight to it, like Indiana Jones punches, you know. And I think that Captain America and Black Widow are probably the best in that movie that as their characters have ever been. Mm-hmm. But I totally get it. I totally get the idea of like, there's just so many of them and they run through they're designed to run through your mind so quickly that sometimes you have a hard time kind of remembering like, oh, that's right, I saw Captain Marvel.
One of the things I liked about Captain Marvel, and I probably liked Ant-Man and the Wasp a little bit better because I feel like it functions kind of as a movie. Just on its own, but I like that both movies exist kind of independently of the larger story, that we take a break from the larger cinematic universe and just tell this little self-contained thing. And, you know, in Captain Marvel, the only real connection is Nick Fury, and my son, who is 10, got very confused because he realized he was watching the same actor for a lot of the movie, but didn't really understand that the movie was set in the 90s because, you know, he doesn't have the frame of reference for '90s music.
Wait, Patrick, wait. This movie was set in the 90s?
Believe it or not. I don't know if you caught one or two of the music cues, but those are actually 90s songs. And she falls into a blockbuster, and there's all these things that are 90s references, and he obviously isn't going to get any of those. So finally, when somehow it was like very spelled out, and he turned to me and he said, wait, that's Nick Fury? I said, yeah. And he said, how? I said, oh, well, you know, this movie takes place in the past. So this is like young Nick Fury. He's not the Nick Fury that you know yet. And there's a pause. And then he turns back to me and says, little does he know, he's going to meet Spider-Man, which I thought was like the greatest thing ever.
That's amazing. And listen, there's one thing we know about Charlie is adamant about Spider-Man. And
he's very, very much so.
So much so that at the expense of Paramount Pictures, as we found out at the this movie fest.
Didn't he also come downstairs in his Spider-Man suit?
He did. Yeah, he did. Yeah.
I feel like anytime there's a group of people here, he makes an appearance as Spider-Man. He's giving the crowd what they want.
And later as Marion Cabretti. So it's all good. But no, Captain Marvel for me overall is good. It's fine. I'm happy it exists. I like Brie Larson. I think Samuel Jackson's having fun. But as a movie, I don't know how often I'll return to it.
Right, right. Yeah.
Next I got, I owed Adam a viewing of Sudden Death, 1995's Sudden Death.
When you say you owed Adam a viewing, was this you lost a bet? What's the story here?
I had never seen it, and sometimes we'll text back and forth and talk about what we're watching and stuff, and he made a reference to Sudden Death, and I was like, oh, that's interesting, and I've never seen that. He was like, what? And he made sure that I rectified that immediately. So I checked out Sudden Death with Jean-Claude Van Damme, and you know, it's Die Hard at the Stanley Cup, which is cool. Here's my question, and as a heavy action man, I need to approach you about this, because mm-hmm. I don't know if I've ever really found my in with Jean-Claude Van Damme. Mm. Like, I don't know if he's my thing just yet. I don't know if I've like absorbed, because I've seen a lot of his movies, but I don't know if I've absorbed enough of the right ones to find that, like, the meat-headed charm that I like I have with Arnold or Sylvester Stallone. You know, like, I know a good Sylvester Stallone role, like when we watch Cobra, and I know a good Arnold role, you know, and I'll actually bring up one later that I thought was not a great Arnold role. I don't know what my in is. So if you had to name, like, let's say two or three, like, defining characteristics of a good Jean-Claude Van Damme movie or performance, what do you think they would be?
Oh, gosh. Well, he's a little bit different than some of the other guys, because I think if you're talking later period Van Damme, you know, he dips out in the 90s and kind of the early 2000s, and he comes back almost reinvented as a little bit of a sad sack, although he makes a movie called Enemies Closer where he's clearly having a blast, or even The Expendables 2, like he is by far the best thing in The Expendables 2. He's a better actor than I think any of his contemporaries. And I don't think he starts out that way. But so if you were to watch something like JCVD, which I don't know that you've seen.
I don't think so, no.
Okay. It's a very interesting. He's playing himself as this action star who gets caught in like a robbery, and he's held hostage. And he has this monologue that's like the most amazing thing you've ever seen. And so he ends up being a really good actor. And so then some of the movies from this current period take on a different weight, even like a Universal Soldier Regeneration or Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning, both of which are amazing. Not as much because of Van Damme, but just because they're so incredibly well directed and they kick so much ass. But he's kind of playing a super sad sack in both of those too. But in the early ones, I mean, you know, sometimes it just depends on what your buy-in is, because I'm so torn on something like Cobra, where like part of me loves how ridiculous Stallone's need to be cool is in that movie. And then part of me resents it. Part of me is annoyed by his relentless need to be so cool.
Because it's distracting?
Yeah, it's like, in a way, it circles back in and around itself, and sort of the irony folds back in. And I'm like, oh, I have to embrace this, because what choice do I have? But like, I don't. One of the things that I really like about Van Damme, and in particular about Schwarzenegger, is their lack of vanity. And Van Damme, by the way, is super vain. So I mean more in his performances. Because when you watch something like Sudden Death, and he's running around in a penguin suit, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Stallone was never going to do that, right? So I like that Van Damme has a willingness to be goofy. Schwarzenegger will allow himself to be the butt of the joke almost always, and Stallone kind of never will. And so I tend to respond more to Van Damme and Schwarzenegger than I do Stallone and Seagal, who to me are a little bit closer in breed. For Van Damme, I mean, have you ever seen like Double Impact?
Yeah. Yep.
Double Impact is a fun one for me, because it feels like fully coked out Van Damme. I mean, I love a lot of his early stuff, but yeah, I don't know that I can pinpoint the one that says, oh, here's why you'll like him.
Okay.
Nowhere to Run is a really good one, and that's just kind of quiet Van Damme. So it's that, sort of the polar opposite of the Double Impact Van Damme.
Yeah, that one I've never seen, Nowhere to Run.
And you know, Cyborg. I'm always going to love Cyborg.
Yeah, that one I have seen. Yes. So I... Albert Pune. Yeah, so now I think I need to find whatever it is that is going to catch me. Not that he necessarily has to or he will, but I mean, I watched this and I liked it. I enjoyed it. But I think as I was watching it, I was trying to figure out where the lines of demarcation are between the action guys. And maybe it's unfair to lump Van Damme in with those guys. But just as a point of reference for me, it was useful. So I just wanted to ask.
So of the four that I named, how do they rank for you?
I think Double Impact is the one I've seen the most. I've probably seen that maybe three times. It's hard for me to remember. I mean, I liked Sudden Death. I'm looking here. Double Impact I've seen, Bloodsport I've seen, Cyborg I've seen,
Time Cop,
Hard Target I've seen. I have not seen Time Cop.
Time Cop is like the closest he came to like a legitimately good movie, like a crossover. It's like when Seagal made Under Siege. It's like, oh, this is his classy picture.
Got it. All right. So I'm going to watch Time Cop, and yeah. I'm going to watch a couple of them. I'm going to watch JCVD as well. And I don't know. I'll report back.
JCVD and those two Universal Soldier movies are the bomb.
Okay. I remember you writing about the Universal Soldier movies. I don't think I've ever seen them.
They are something else. Have you ever seen the original Universal Soldier?
No.
I think it helps, especially in seeing Regeneration. I think it helps to have seen the original. You don't necessarily have to, but I would almost say watch the three, like, you know, consecutively. Yeah. And they're all three are completely different experiences, especially when you get to Day of Reckoning, which is the action movie as like horror art film. It has way more like Gaspar Noé and David Lynch in it than it does. Yes. Yeah, it's wild.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, these are going on the list. Okay.
Rank the action stars. Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Seagal, Van Damme.
I was watching Creed 2 with my family last night, which I hadn't revisited since the theater.
I still haven't seen it. I'm so sorry.
You're fine. I was texting Adam. I like it more the second time. But I don't know if that means it's a better movie. I think I just love hanging out with those characters. It's that kind of thing. And my mom and I were talking about how, we were sort of talking about Stallone and so on. And we were saying that, or I was kind of saying that I think that no matter what I see Stallone do, and I've seen him be good and bad and things, and we were talking about his ego and stuff. There's something about when he's playing Rocky that just feels like, you know, slipping on a shoe that fits, you know, that kind of thing. It feels effortless. For me, though, personality-wise, it's got to be Arnold. I mean, it's got to be – no, I don't think anybody embodies – I mean, is there anybody else that embodies that, for at least maybe for our age group, like that big budget? Like he is a force. He knows he is a force.
Right.
He is willing to go along with the thing. As you mentioned, he's willing to be the butt of the joke sometimes. I was actually talking to somebody, my friend at work. We were looking at the timeline of his movies, and – Arnold started poking fun at himself pretty early in his career.
Yeah.
I mean, it was early 90s, right? Because we had Twins was pretty early. Kindergarten Cop was pretty early. I mean, at least for him being Arnold the way he was to us when we were younger.
Right.
I think to me it's probably Arnold is number one for me. Stallone comes after just because I have so much love for Rocky. And then the other ones, I would still of the big ones, I would still need to dig in more. And I think Van Damme is going to be the next one that I really kind of try to dig into to get a better sense of what it is that I connect with. But the Universal Soldier movies are going to be next for me, I think.
Nice.
Speaking of which, I wanted to bring up the nice transition here to Raw Deal, which I was watching for 1986 week. I want to know what you think about Raw Deal because it. First of all, I couldn't believe. It wasn't a canon film. I found out it was a De Laurentiis film, which made sense. Side note for a second, rank in terms of quality to let's say, enjoyment, pure quality to enjoyment level ratio, Canon, AIP, De Laurentiis.
Oh, gosh. I think AIP probably had... I definitely enjoy Canon the most. I think AIP has more actual good movies.
Okay.
But if I'm you're laying out the catalog in front of me, I'm going to go Canon, AIP, De Laurentiis.
Got it.
Yeah.
So Raw Deal to me strikes me as a movie that felt very different because it clearly wasn't written with Arnold in mind. In fact, I read that he basically did it just to get out of his contract for the Conan films. It feels like this role could have gone to like Charles Bronson or really anyone.
Yeah.
I remember I went back and looked at a column you wrote where it's like, it's Arnold's otherness times like four, because he's this, you know, Austrian man playing sort of kind of an American playing kind of a, what is he?
It's like a mobster, right?
A Chicago mobster. Yeah. This kind of he's four or five times removed from an actual human being. I don't know. I there were things about Raw Deal I like, but overall I was a little bit. It didn't feel like it had any kind of real. It didn't have a thing that really grabbed me.
Yeah, I don't think it's one of his more memorable movies. It feels like this weird little sort of minor offshoot in between Commando in 85 and Predator in 87. And it's one of his movies I've probably seen the least because I can't conjure it up by memory the way I can so many of his other movies. I know, you know, I know Commando and Predator and Running Man basically by heart, and Raw Deal I kind of remember like Don't Drink and Bake and that, and not much else, you know. So I would need to watch it again. I know I wrote about it and it was like the first ever heavy action. It just happened that I had like watched three action movies in a weekend and I was like, well, maybe there's a column there. And then I started doing it a little bit differently. So I haven't watched it since then, but yeah, I don't remember it ever really knocking me out. I remember it using a Rolling Stones song too.
Right. Which is, I think I even went ahead and read that it's one of the only times you hear like a needle drop in an Arnold movie. But yeah, it very much felt like it's like, here's an action, you know, it clearly it wasn't, I think Arnold's films, he tailored them to himself in a way in later roles that ended up obviously being very successful. But this one felt like it was Arnold playing a role that could have gone to basically anyone.
Yeah.
Which is disappointing.
In my memory, it was sort of comparable with Cobra in that both Stallone and Schwarzenegger kind of are fully formed in 85 with Commando and Rambo First Blood Part 2 respectively, that they are sort of anointed, you know, these action movie giants, and then they both come out with sort of lesser imitators with Raw Deal and Cobra. But Cobra was actually a big hit. Cobra was like one of the 20 highest grossing movies of 86, which I did not realize. And Raw Deal was less of a hit, I believe.
Yeah. It's all about the sunglasses.
Yeah.
Last thing I'll talk about is Operation Finale, which I saw. Here's the question. I have this with a lot of based on a true story movies, and I think this is where I've fallen. I think these days I'm judging true story movies by whether or not I would get more enjoyment out of the movie or the Wikipedia article. and in Operation Finale's case, I think I would got more out of the Wikipedia article. Mm-hmm. Very good actors doing very good actorly things. Ben Kingsley is having fun. Oscar Isaac is wearing 60s period clothes, which is very exciting for a lot of us. I mean, fine. Not anything. Again, it's you could read the Wikipedia page and basically get what you need out of that movie.
It sure has a terrible title. I'm not one to usually criticize titles, but I remember even when that movie was out thinking like, oh, they probably should have gone with something else there.
Well, you don't think it's a dramatic finale.
I know it's right. Finale, and I know it's Patrick. The name of the actual thing, but like, right. So what, you know,
yeah.
take some cinematic license and call it Operation Scorpion.
Call it Ben Kingsley Takes a Shit, because that happens in that movie.
Oh, well, now I'm going to see it.
And then he talks about taking a shit, and that's fun. Fine dad movie, but nothing you need to rush out for.
What prompted you to watch that when you haven't yet seen the Universal Soldier movies?
I was watching it with my stepdad. He put it on. I was up with my family this weekend, and I picked Creed 2, so he went with Operation Finale.
So he was trying to punish you? I haven't seen it. I'm taking all these shots at Operation Finale. It is a movie I have not seen. I might love it.
It's not bad. It's just not anything that you haven't seen before.
Yeah. I don't have a ton of stuff because, again, I went right from like 1986 movies to all these Irish horror movies for a thing I was writing for something. And so last week I did host a screening of The Matrix, which I hadn't seen in probably 15 years. The last time I saw The Matrix was a day that I marathoned all three of The Matrix movies, and I haven't watched any of them since. And I usually rewatch the movie before I host one of these screenings just to kind of refresh it and figure out what I'm going to talk about. But I intentionally didn't want to because I wanted the first time I revisit the movie for the first time in 15 years to be on the big screen. Turns out that movie holds up.
It does.
Yeah. It's very good. It is. You know, we talk a lot about 1999 and all of the movies that we got that are sort of miracles and that we feel like we'll never get this again. And The Matrix is one of those that just this movie that these two great filmmakers snuck by and somehow got Warner Brothers to spend $60 million on. And even reading about, like, I think I looked on the Box Office Mojo page and it was so interesting because I think it opened in fourth place with like $10 million. And then in week two, it was number one with $40 million. If you want to talk about what a word of mouth hit that movie is, because nobody knows what to make of it. You can't tell by the marketing. Keanu Reeves, not a giant movie star. You're just like, huh? I don't get what that is. I'm going to go see Never Been Kissed instead. And then people tell you, no, you need to see it. It's so cool. And boy, it is. I mean, it really kind of, you know, for, I think mostly for worse, it changed movies for a long time. I don't think it was a movie that, you know, studios learned the right lessons from. So they were just trying to copy aspects of The Matrix, whether it's like, oh, we'll use this sort of techno industrial music, or we'll have everyone wear black leather or bullet time or whatever it is, instead of saying let's let filmmakers make big, crazy, audacious, ambitious, original movies. Nobody said that after seeing The Matrix. They all just imitated elements of The Matrix. But I was watching the scene where, you know, Neo is awoken and I guess spoilers for The Matrix, like, pops up in a pool of slime, completely hairless, plugged in to a computer where a giant squid robot looks at him and then flushes him like down a toilet. I'm like, what? This is a $60 million movie. This played in theaters. Everyone saw this. Like, now we just accept it as, oh yeah, well, that's The Matrix. But like, look at what they're doing in this movie. It's unreal how good that movie is.
I'll tell you one thing that movie did change was fashion at my middle school. We were all Neo. We all needed that flip phone, the phone that pops out from the bottom.
Yeah.
Hit the button on the side. No, yeah. I show The Matrix every year in my film class when we do the sci-fi genre. And boy, I mean, it does. I mean, speak of holding up, it captivates even people who had kind of heard of it, sort of heard of it. Then we have to have the discussion about the sequels. And no, it holds up. And I mean, it's amazing. It's even after watching Bound for the first time a couple weeks ago, I guess now, I get so much more of an appreciation for the Wachowskis and what they were able to do with that. And the fact that, like you said, they snuck that by. I remember seeing it. I didn't get to see it in the theater. I wasn't quite old enough, but I remember renting it and convincing. I was begging my dad to let me rent it. And he was like, what is it? And I'm like, I don't know, but everyone at my school is talking about it. Like, I need to see this movie, like renting it from Blockbuster on VHS. Cause like, you just desperately needed to see it. And then thankfully he was into it. He thought it was pretty cool. He pronounces Keanu Reeves, name Canoe. Shout out to my dad. He calls him Canoe, which is always fun. He's like, he's a really cool guy. His name's Canoe. Like, how cool is that? But no, it absolutely holds up. And I had breakfast with Adam, I think Sunday before I left, and we were talking. We watched that video of Will Smith that's going around where he talks about why he turned down The Matrix. Did you see that one yet?
I have not. No.
he has like a YouTube channel, I think, Will Smith, where he just like sits in his hotel room and tells stories. I don't know. But he told a story about turning down the Matrix, that the Wachowskis came to him with the Matrix, told him that they were going to hire, I think, Val Kilmer as Morpheus. And essentially he says that he didn't understand the movie, and he says it was basically a bad pitch because the Wachowskis were so obsessed with explaining what bullet time was that Will Smith said he couldn't really even get a sense of what the story was at all because they were so captivated by this idea of trying to explain the sort of, the relative physics of what it means to stop in one place and keep moving in another place. And, you know, Will Smith was sort of, I guess, just not sold on it. He didn't really know what to make of it. So he sort of jokingly says in that video, like, yeah, he's like, you know, but you know what? At the end of the day, Keanu was great. I would have ruined the Matrix. So, you know, because I didn't understand what the hell was going on with that. I thought it was cool of him to say that. But I can imagine, like you said, speaking of sneaking it by, I can imagine what it must have been like. How much trust. I think at that point, that's Joel Silver, right?
Yeah.
And how much they must have just been like, all right, Joel, whatever. Like, go ahead, I guess, if you think so. You know, because at that point, I think he had carte blanche for a couple projects. Or maybe it was after The Matrix that he had carte blanche for a lot of things. But how much trust they must have had either in the filmmaker or in the producer or whatever it is, because boy, I mean, like you said, those are movies that could get made at an indie level, but $60 million at that time.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Which looks like 200.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, that movie's a miracle.
They only made Bound to show that they could make a movie. Joel Silver was like, yeah, I like this script for The Matrix, but I'm never going to let you guys direct it. You've never made anything. And so he said, go make a movie, you know? And they did, and it was Bound. And I think Bound is so amazing. I love that that's their, like, demo reel. That they're like, oh, okay, we'll just make this little thing to prove that we can direct, and then we make this amazing little neo-noir thriller that's so much better than it needs to be if the purpose is just to show that they know how to direct. It's great. Are you a fan of the sequels?
I watched...
There's my answer.
I watched the trailer for The Matrix Reloaded 10,000 times. It was dial-up internet days. It was back in the day where you they posted, I think probably on Ain't It Cool News, they posted the video, and I remember downloading it, and I probably came home from school every day and watched the trailer for The Matrix Reloaded and just tried to figure out what it would be. I think there are things about The Matrix Reloaded that work really well.
Yeah.
I think fewer things work about The Matrix Revolutions.
Yeah.
The Matrix Reloaded is a movie where if it's on, I'm going to watch it for sure. Because there are just so many fascinating things about the way they expanded the world but it's those two movies. They just fall apart for me the more I think about them, and they frustrate me. I try to answer, but students ask me all the time, oh, should I watch the other two? Like, you know, 'cause it's all new to them. And I'm like, you know, watch it, you know, make up your own mind, definitely. But they're not movies that I think helped the cause. I think that if The Matrix had ended where The Matrix ended at the end of the first one, you know, we might be talking about The Matrix more. And I meant to ask you, how did the screening go?
It went well. I mean, it wasn't really a situation where people were being introduced to it, I don't think. I feel like most of the people there had already seen it, which isn't always the case. I did Alien a few months ago, and nearly half the audience had never seen Alien. Most of the audience had seen The Matrix, but had not seen it theatrically, maybe because they were too young or who knows. So it was very, very cool to watch it with a group of, you know, very enthusiastic people. And there was a good turnout. So I was happy with it. It was fun. And again, I'm just happy to. I can't believe that movie's 20 years old, but it turns 20 this month, which is insane.
What are you? Where are you on the sequels?
You know, same. There's stuff in the second one that I like, but and I was trying to, as I was doing the Q&A afterwards, I was really trying to figure out the difference. You know, one of the things I think is that The Matrix ends in such a cool place that nothing in the subsequent two movies lives up to some of the powers we see him have at the end of the original Matrix, including where he flies away, which is like so cool. And then even though we do technically see him fly in the sequels, it doesn't mean anything. It's not the same. And also just that the first movie gets the balance of everything exactly right. There's never too much philosophy, never too much action, never too much science fiction nonsense. You know, it's like it gives you just enough and then it gives you something else.
And I think that's the root of what's wrong with the sequels, exactly. Which is that it goes so far into lore and yes. trying to explain these things, and it just gets – I mean, they kill Trinity four times in each movie.
Right. And I can't fault the Wachowskis for, like, they were interested in something about the Matrix that isn't the thing that I was interested in, right? So that's what they pursued. So I can't say, oh, they were wrong – to chase the wrong thing, but like that's not the stuff about the Matrix that made me love it. And so I even think the action is kind of overblown, you know.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. Well, at that point you're Phantom Menacing it, where you're just trying to push the boundaries of right. what you've seen before, you know, the burly brawl and stuff is just like, well, we got away with it before, let's just push, let's right. just see what happens.
Right.
I think there is something to be said for, and this is just the storytelling in general, the reason why the Matrix works is because you're with Neo as he enters the world. You know, it's the audience surrogate, all that stuff. Your protagonist is entering this world, crossing a threshold, going into this sort of underworld of fantastic things and all that. And the sequels, he's a presence. He's Space Jesus. You know, he's Computer Jesus, and he's in the world, and he's overblown and overpowered, and it's kind of a continuation of his journey. But the further you go into God world, the more scaffolding you need around you, like right. you said, of the philosophy, and that gets boring. That's the thing that's not interesting or coherent about the Matrix movies. That's not exciting. I was actually just talking about this, not to bring up students again, but I'm teaching The Handmaid's Tale, the novel, and I was talking a little bit because I have students in my class who are just like, yeah, but wait, what about this? What about that? What about that? Well, what's going on with this? And, you know, if you're not familiar with The Handmaid's Tale, it's sort of this dystopian world where women have no power, and basically it's this big patriarchy. I know it's hard to imagine that. but I was saying to them, like, no, the really fun part about the story is that you don't know every detail. You are in the character Offred's position, where you just know as much as she knows. And the more you pull at that thread of the logic behind, well, wait, hold on, if they did this, then why didn't they do that? And was there a period where this happened? The more you pull on that thread, the more the world falls apart. And not only that, but the less interesting it becomes. So I feel like the Matrix sequels just pull on that thread a little bit too much. And we find that, as you said, the best story to tell was the first one.
Right. Right. Well, and the first one is sort of set up not as a mystery, but there is, I mean, it's 45 minutes before they even tell you what the Matrix is.
Right.
There's the question of, is Neo the one or not? There are questions that you are carrying with you for the whole movie. And then it, you know, answers them in a satisfying way. And the sequels don't really have that mystery. The mystery is more like, what the fuck is going on? You know, and that's not a mystery that you want your audience solving, and it tries to play the game of like, oh, well, maybe he's not the one, even though we already established he is, and that's no good.
I think it's a common problem. I was just I was writing about Twin Peaks, and like, you have the really cool, interesting thing about Twin Peaks is you have Twin Peaks, which exists on its own, the three seasons with Mark Frost and David Lynch. And then you have Fire Walk With Me, which is just David Lynch. And you have the two novels, the two Twin Peaks novels, which are just Mark Frost and some of the other external Twin Peaks stuff that David Frost has done on his own. And Mark Frost is really good. Sorry about that.
No.
Mark Frost is really good with lore and world building and logic behind pieces and putting mysteries together. And David Lynch is really good with characters and emotions and tone. And when you separate those two things, they work to varying degrees. But I think when you look at, for example, the difference between Fire Walk With Me and an episode of the original series of Twin Peaks, you can see the differences. You can see where there's a missing influence, or maybe one influence is emphasized where the other one isn't. And I think it's similar in this kind of form of storytelling, where you can tell that, as you said, the driving focus of the first Matrix are these questions that have very little to do with space computer world.
Right.
Whereas the sequels, they rely so much on that it stops being interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. The second one has like one cool thing that almost rivals him flying away in the second one, which is where they reveal, I guess, you know, spoilers for The Matrix Reloaded, the reveal of him sort of having some Matrixy powers in the real world.
Right.
I thought was neat. But again, I don't feel like that ever pays off. It's just a cool cliffhanger that you're like, oh, look what he can do now. And then you go see revolutions, and it's like, no, that didn't matter. Okay.
I don't like revolutions, I don't think.
I don't think I do either, but again, I've seen it maybe twice. I saw it the night it came out, and then I watched it again as part of, you know, watching all three of them in a row, and have not seen it since.
I'm going to focus on Universal Soldier first, then maybe I'll go back and do Revolution.
Let's actually focus on Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist now that we've done 40 minutes on The Matrix.
You're welcome.
I will go ahead and I'm going to skip over some of the other stuff I've seen so that we can talk about what we came to talk about, which is Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. This is a movie based on a novel that I own but have not read. And it was a movie that I wanted to see enough in 2008. So Erica and I went because we saw everything back then. And this was on my top 10 of 2008.
Nice, nice. I wasn't making top 10s back then, but I imagine it probably would have been on mine too.
Well, and it's a weird thing, and I want to get to the bottom of it as we talk about it, because even back in 2008, and again today, 9 years later, as I'm rewatching it, it's like, it's not a, it's deeply flawed. <It is. laughs> The things that work, I think, work so well that it pushed it into top 10 territory for me. There's aspects of it that I respond to so much. And I really thought that it was, I think at the, back then what I said was, and I don't know if this is still true, but in 2008, this felt true, that it was a movie so much of its time that it felt ahead of its time. And I don't think that that has quite panned out. Like, I don't think we watch Nick and Nora now and say, oh, this movie was ahead of its time, because it probably wasn't. But there were things that it acknowledged and said about young people and about the world that they lived in. And again, I was a younger man when I saw this movie in 2008, that I just felt like, oh, other movies aren't doing this. Other movies aren't giving young people the credit that this movie is giving them. And so the stuff that I liked leapt out at me so much that I really latched onto it and was willing to overlook some stuff that I don't think is very good, which is like the structure and several characters. I think that it's kind of a messy movie, in both good and bad ways. And, but again, the stuff that I like, I still really, really like. But where are you at on this one? This was your suggestion, and it was a good one.
I think so. Yeah, I think this was my suggestion, and I think I brought it up in the wake of our rousing success with Josie and the Pussycats, which, I mean, just every day someone tells me how much they love that podcast. No, this is a movie that means a lot to me, and I like a lot of what you said about it saying something about kids or young people that not every movie says. Just real quick, I also own the book. I did read it, I think, after I saw the movie. And it's worth noting, we were talking about the structure. The novel's broken up into chapters that alternate perspectives. It's like a Game of Thrones kind of deal, where it's like one is from Nick's perspective, one is from Nora's perspective. And they were written, allegedly, in order by the two writers, Rachel Cohn and David Levithan, basically by passing each chapter back and forth. That's the legend. That's what they say. Who knows if that's, you know, BS or not. But with that in mind, I think, you know, we can see maybe where the messiness comes from, but also where a lot of the naturalism comes from. So I think in converting that into a screenplay, I think there was a lot of maybe some things that had to be adjusted. But I think overall, it is a mess, but I think it's coherent in its at least in its kind of tone, I think, except for a couple of little things. I like this movie a lot. Two things. One, I grew up playing in rock bands and stuff, and the high school, not so much in the college, but I think these guys are more kind of on the cusp of college age. It was more for me in the high school range, which was, you know, the idea of being young and heading out into the night to go play a show or go see a show at like a shitty little venue or something, and then spending the rest of the night kind of traveling around in these groups and like getting into trouble at like a third location or something. Like, it's very nostalgic for me. I like it a lot. A lot of the fun that I had growing up was that, where it's kind of, you know, going out into the night and, you know, having that fun energy of playing a show and then meeting up with friends afterwards, or, you know, those kinds of things. And that being kind of a centerpiece of a lot of the relationships that I built at that point in my life. So there's a lot of nostalgia there for that for me. Also, just the douchiness of Michael Cera. I mean, boy, was I having flashbacks watching that. Like, I made the joke about the never washing your pants thing. Like, I definitely said that to somebody at some point. Like, I was that douche. I was making those mix CDs. And like, I love the way, I love Kat Dennings in this movie, which we'll talk about, I'm sure. And I love that she has no patience for his douchiness, which made me so happy in retrospect, because boy, oh boy, did I connect with that. And I also just really love Up All Night movies. You know, like Running Scared, the 2006 version, After Hours. Like, there's something very hypnotic and kind of, I think, like, intrinsically cinematic about that format. The idea of, like, characters being up all night in a one crazy night kind of thing. There's something relentless about that type of movie that just feels good when you're watching it. They're always really good. The good ones, anyway, are always really good movies to hang out with. I like the idea of characters kind of leaving the safety of the familiar to go out into this world and all your tests, enemies, and allies, all that Joseph Campbell stuff I love. And it's really romantic and very much like a fairy tale. And I think that the whole, like, New York is a character thing is typically, like, really obnoxious in movies, but it feels organic to me here. I might be wrong about that. Maybe some people might disagree. At least in the sense that these kids know the city and they understand how to move through it.
Right.
You know, it's the kind of movie that, like, yes, it was shot in this city and it shows off these landmarks, but they feel like home to the kids. It's not a movie about, like, touristy stuff or anything like that. It's the kids moving from place to place, like they actually live there. And then there's, like, a nice element. Sorry, just sort of in my introductory thoughts here. That whole idea of that plays into the theme of the kind of, I don't want to say one night love story, but the stakes of, you know, relationships, especially for high school kids or college kids, or like these great long lasting loves and all that. I think those are stories that are worth telling, but I also really love the idea of, you know, the one character says at one point about the Beatles, how it wasn't, you know, I want to marry you. I want to be with you 1,000 years. I just want to hold your hand, you know? And that to me about, that's where to me, the heart of this movie is, which is, these are kids that are trying to figure out right now. And there's something really gratifying and romantic and fun and just really thematically interesting about, like, just, you just want to hold this person's hand tonight. Like, you just want to be with them tonight. You want to, you know, hang out with these people. You want to maybe kiss that girl or that boy, or it doesn't have to go further than that. It doesn't have to be any big thing that changes your life. It's just tonight, you know, kind of like playing on stage and stuff like that. It's like tonight, the way I feel is how I want to feel. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something really, really connectable, relatable, romantic about that. And that to me is the crux of this movie. That's why it sticks with me despite all of its very, very glaring flaws.
Well, we've had those nights, you know, and I think when the movie keys into that, it captures that feeling exactly right, like you're saying. It too often, like, I think when it gets Michael Cera and Kat Dennings together, you know, that's money in the bank. That's like, oh, this movie is really clicking. And I understand that part of its dramatic function has to be to continually pull them apart, to send them off in separate directions, or to throw obstacles in their way, to throw X's in their way. I think the way it does it is often incredibly clunky. And I think even the – I'm totally with you on the one crazy night thing. I just sometimes, you know, it's a little arbitrary in terms of, like, now we have to go here. Now we're here. Now here's this cameo. Now we're talking to this person. And I know some of that was, I think, you know, all the stuff with Caroline. And again, I haven't read the book, but I did read that the stuff with We Have to Get Caroline was added for the movie.
Yeah, I don't remember too much about the book. It was a while ago, but we have to talk about Ari Grainer as Caroline.
Ari Grainer has been done dirty by Hollywood, because every time I see her in something, she's fantastic. And I didn't watch that Showtime show that she was, like, the lead of. And I forgot up until I started making this sentence that she was the lead of a Showtime show, because I was about to say, why has she never been given an opportunity? I know she was like on the Bad Teacher TV show, which I never saw and I think was canceled very early. And I was like, how come Ari Grainer's never been given a chance? And then I remembered as I was saying it, oh, she was the lead of that Showtime show that didn't last very long. I don't think, maybe a season, maybe two. But yeah, she's just someone who should have a bigger career than she has.
She steals this movie. I mean,
yeah,
she is so good. and maybe that's just me. I don't know. I think she's just excellent. At a certain point, I was just writing down quotes, which apparently she improvised a lot of this stuff, which she keeps asking everybody if they're mad at her. And
such a great drunk thing.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. When she says, you have to be very quiet. And then, there's an altar boy with no pants on. Like, I just keep writing down these quotes. But my all time favorite thing that she's done, and I tried to find like a gif of this to post the other day, is when she says hi to her turkey sandwich, which again is one of those drunk moments that's just so fun. And I know we're off track here, but like, the one thing I really like about that movie, if we could talk about that for a second, the idea of the drunk best friend, because I think that is one of the two, like, when you look at all these, like you said, slightly arbitrary things that are, or clunky things that are pulling the two of them apart, Nick and Nora, you've got, the Jay Baruchel, the boyfriend character, you've got the Where's Fluffy pursuit, and you've kind of got drunk Caroline and then the other ex, Nick's ex. There are lots of ways to go with drunk best friend character in a teen movie. I like the way they handle her in this. I like that at the very least, everybody in the story sort of understands that they've all kind of had a night like that and all kind of take collective responsibility for her safety. Mm-hmm. Like there's an interesting thing about that where I like that the kids in the van are going to drive her around, and of course they lose her at one point, which is silly. And, Kat Dennings' character kind of laments the fact that she always has to take care of her best friend and all that, but there is still so much to her that is valuable. She's not the load, she's not like being dragged around, for the sake of the story, even though I know on the surface she is, but there's something about the way she's portrayed and the way the other characters handle her that makes it like, oh no, she's an important part of this, even though we don't see that. She's an important part of this. This is just how it's going, and we need to make sure that she gets home safe. I like that about this, I think. I don't know. For me, that was effective.
No, I do too. I do too. It's a weird thing because taken sort of individually, I like so many of the supporting characters. And then when I drill down and like actually think about like, but why are they in this movie? But what does this movie have them do? Sometimes I'm like, oh, I don't know if they all work together in the same movie. I think what's her name playing Nick's ex, Triss, or whatever, right?
Alexis Zania?
Sure. I think she does a good job, right? Like, but I just think what she's asked to do makes no sense most of the time. And one of the things that I really liked about the movie again in 2008, and that I still like about it today, was that it has several gay characters and that their sexuality does not define them, and that it is not, I don't want to say an issue because it never should be an issue, but just that all of the young people are, I don't know. I grew up in a time where if there were gay characters, like that was their thing. This character's gay, and you might have one character who's like, okay with it. And then all the other characters are going to like laugh or something because it was the 80s and homophobia was so often played as a joke. And so it was very refreshing to see a movie in which everyone is just like, yeah, you're gay, I'm not, and we all live in the world. Because that, I was like, well, that's what the world is. And that's what I think is more and more the case with young people now, is that, sexuality is not – it doesn't differentiate us the way that it did when I was growing up in terms of pop culture.
It's worth noting that this movie was nominated for a GLAAD Media Award. So okay. Obviously, well, somebody agrees with you. Yeah.
Right. I thought that that was really cool. I thought, like you said, the idea of them being able to navigate the city on their own in like this adultless world, I thought, Yeah, that's another thing that, like, we don't give young people credit for being able to do, that they can just get around New York on their own and know what they're doing. Like, there was all this stuff. I know I'm jumping ahead and we got to come back to some of the other stuff, but like the sort of love scene that Nick and Nora have at the end of the film, I thought was almost revolutionary when I saw it. I was even watching it again, last night / today. Erica kind of articulated exactly what I was thinking, where she said, like, I love that that's all they did.
Yeah.
That we don't have to have them, like, have sex with each other. That they mess around a little bit, and there's a specific act that it seems to be implied. So it's like, we acknowledge that these are sexual people who are going to do more than just a little bit of necking, but we also don't have to go so far as to have them, like, have sex or lose their virginity or, like, oh, you're the one. Like you said, it's not about, like, this forever thing.
Exactly.
It is.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. The
only
thing
I just want
to throw in there was that it's also worth noting that it's a scene that's focused, not to put too much point on it, but it's focused on her pleasure.
Yes, which I wish hadn't been
as explicit.
Yeah, because of how they tip it at the beginning of the movie. Like, she's never had an orgasm. And then when he gives her one, it's like, well, hey, now he climbed Everest.
That's obnoxious. But I like, outside of that context, I like that scene.
As do I. Yeah, that's all. I thought it was like, oh, you don't ever see that in a movie. You don't see movies that acknowledge, like, sexual acts that aren't just intercourse. It's so rare that movies acknowledge, like, oh, there's other stuff you can do.
Right. And that they have weight and that they have meaning and that it's rumors. And I mean, she initiates it, you know, it's that kind of thing where it's just such a nice moment between the two of them. And like you said, it goes back to this idea of, like, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It doesn't have to be everything. Right. It doesn't have to be a life changing thing. It just be, you know, I want to hold your hand.
Right. And even the little details, the way that they talk about the button not working or her buttoning up her pants when they're done, it's like, it all feels very, every time the two of them are together, it's like, oh, this is a movie. This is such a good movie about young people kind of falling for each other in a very specific way. It just sometimes has to be interrupted by shenanigans, and I find myself less interested in the shenanigans and a little bit less in the, you know, the way that Triss keeps throwing herself at him. I get it, and I get what they're trying to say, and I get that they're trying to present him with a choice, but it doesn't feel believable to me beyond, like, at a certain point, you know, when we get to the end of the film and Tall and Triss are both still trying to pull them away from each other. It's like, we're still doing this after he left her and she's there with the new boyfriend and she's still like, can we just go? Like, what?
Tall at the very least has his motivation. By the way, I love that a movie, and this is no disrespect to either actor, but I love that Michael Cera and Jay Baruchel are the hunky competitive romantic leads in this movie. You don't see that very often, you know, which I thought was pretty cool. Tall at the very least has his ulterior motive with, you know, wanting to get the record deal. But yeah, I mean, Triss's character is not served well. And I think that the way I've justified it is, like, maybe it's a point of view thing. Maybe she is so two dimensional because parts of it are from Nick's point of view, and maybe that's the way he sees her. Maybe that's a stretch, but
We also get her from Nora's point of view, where she's equally.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, you're right. Okay, well, throw that out. Never mind. Working stuff out here. I agree with you. I agree. She is the least well served by this whole thing.
I love all the stuff about Judaism. And again, how casual it is about these characters' relationship to their religion. It's just, it presents all these things that in other movies would have been the thing. And in this movie, it's just an aspect of who these people are.
It's a thing. Yeah.
Right.
I actually ended up doing a little bit of research this morning on that, Tikkun Olam. I apologize if I'm pronouncing it wrong. The idea that Nora says that the world's been broken into pieces and it's up to everybody basically to do good works to put it back together again. You know, I think that's, you know, and Nick then goes on and says, maybe we're the pieces, you know, which is like cheesy, but again, it speaks to that theme of the movie, which is this idea of, I don't know. There's something romantic about this movie in a way that to go back to that up all night thing where it's these little, God, I sound so douchey, but like these little like fireflies going out into the night, and all these kids are, and these people are all crossing paths. And I'm like looking at this like cityscape in my mind, and it's nighttime, and it's, and you know, they're all interacting with each other and bonding together and then separating and going here and going there. And it's this nice little, I have this whole cosmology in my head of like this little universe where all these people, all these experiences are happening, which is why, like, at the end of the movie, when Ari Grainer shouts, "I love you, New York," which is, can really not work in a movie. I don't care. I love it in this movie. It's one of the few times I actually like it, where it's like, no, fuck yeah, me too, you know?
It's just Winston at the end of Ghostbusters. I love this town.
That's how it works. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just Erica and I are about to go to New York like next week. And so it was really fun to watch this and kind of get excited, you know, all the shots in the city and all the places. We're like, oh, yeah, we kind of looked into going there or whatever. It was a fun little primer for our upcoming trip.
Even as like the long even that long sort of tracking shot that kind of dollies across Penn Station at near the end.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many little moments here, like as they're sort of coming back out of the city, and there's that moment where he asks her if she wants to go home. There's just this really nice slow pan across the Penn Station sign, and it's like, here's our exit. You know what I mean? Here's right. The threshold. Here's the return threshold. We're going to go back out of the world, back into normal life. And he says, you know, as he's sort of walking up the escalator that's going the wrong way, he's kind of like, come on, let's, you know, let's go. You ready to go home? You know, it's such a, like, I don't know. It's just such a sweet way. I'm kind of in love with this movie more than I think it's a good movie. I think it's one of those movies for me.
Oh, that's totally where I'm at.
Where there's just so many things about it that I'm just in love with, despite, you know, all the obvious problems.
Exactly. And I probably, when I let off, I probably sounded more critical than I mean to, because that's exactly how I feel, where it's like the things that I love about this movie transcend any of the problems that I have. I know that for the purposes of a discussion, I need to be able to be like, oh, but this is weird and this is weird. But yeah, ultimately, it doesn't matter, because when we get to that ending, you know, if a movie sticks the landing, I'm definitely going to be a sucker for it. And this movie totally sticks the landing, because you get the great song, Last Words by the Real Tuesday Weld, and you get them leaving together, and it's very romantic. And just her saying, like, you don't want to miss it. And he said, we're not missing it. This is it.
This is it. Yeah.
And that is like just a little piece of poetry right there. I love it. and so, yeah, it totally sticks the landing. So I leave the theater being like, oh my God, I'm smitten with this movie. Totally.
Can we talk for a second about Kat Dennings?
Let's.
In a general sense, by the way, from Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, just a few minutes from where I'm sitting, just a few minutes from where I'm sitting now. I want to know how you feel about this, because I think the year 2008 was a big year for me and Kat Dennings, because she was also in Charlie Bartlett, which is a movie I like a lot. She's got this thing about her that I know she has a successful, is Two Broke Girls still on?
I don't think it is.
I've never watched it, but I'm happy to see that she, you know, got a nice, she was working, you know, obviously. And so we talked a lot about these beautiful young actresses who sort of get that one shot.
Right,
and
right.
Then, I want to know what it is that's different about her. And I was hoping maybe we could work this out. Cause she doesn't feel to me like a Rachel McAdams. She doesn't feel to me necessarily like even like a Rosario Dawson. There's something distinctive, or a Rachel Lee Cook. There's something distinctive about her. And the only thing I wrote down was old soul, which I know just sounds so stupid, but there's a weird wisdom to her that I really like. She's witty and smart and not in that manic pixie dream girl way. Like, even though movies have tried to pitch her in that direction, I think this movie does that sometimes too. But I love that she is the character in this movie who knows she knows everything. Like, she's got the secret. She doesn't reveal the thing about her dad. She's putting up with Tall. She's putting up with the idea of going out with this guy. She's putting up with the idea of, do I go to Columbia, or I'm sorry, do I go to Brown, or do I go to work at Electric Lady? Do I do this? Do I do that? She's the one with kind of the most stakes, and the way she's kind of handling it internally. Like, I just wrote down unlimited salted meat plate in my notes. Like, because at the end of the movie, she just goes to a diner and she just starts eating salted meats, because that's how I deal with frustration as well. So I really felt that. I felt seen in that moment. But I don't know, what are your thoughts on Kat Dennings just generally?
One of the things that I like about her in this movie is, as you said, she's kind of the one who has everyone's number. But it also, I think, starts with her coming from a place of vulnerability, even though she knows that, like, who Nick is and kind of has him figured out and just essentially has to wait for him to figure it out. Like, you're going to get over Triss because she sucks, but I kind of have to stand here and wait for you to figure that out. But it's also coming from a place of vulnerability because it opens with her kind of having a crush on this guy she doesn't know based on, well, he makes these amazing mixes and he's like speaking directly to me through the music he picks, which again goes back to that high fidelity thing, right? And so when she finds out that it's him, it's like she's sort of immediately interested, but then again kind of stands to be hurt because it's like, but he's hung up on his ex. Kat Dennings is interesting because I think this movie makes the best use of her. I think, like you said, she does have a certain thing where she gets it in a way that a lot of other people don't. But I think what that so often translates to with her on screen is a lot of like sarcasm and eye rolling. And yeah. I think she ends up being like snarky best friend. And Two Broke Girls, I had to review a season of that show, and it is 100%. Snarky best friend. I think of her in Thor, and it's like snarky best friend. It's just a lot of like, she has big eyes, and so let's have her roll them a lot and say something sarcastic. And it's not that she's not sarcastic in this movie, but I think this movie acknowledges some of her sarcasm as a defense mechanism.
It's all about vulnerability.
Yeah. And it allows her to constantly be awkward, and I like how much she leans into the awkwardness, where sometimes she's talking just to fill the space and then realizes what she's saying is nonsense. And she has a way of coming at dialogue that isn't the same way that like any other actor would come at the dialogue. Sometimes she kind of throws it away, sometimes it's just about the way she hits a certain word. I want to say what her response to when he says, like, where's Fluffy? They're my favorite band. The way she says they're my favorite band is not exactly how I would hear any other actor say it, but it's exactly the way I would hear a person in life say it. Yeah. And I thought that was super interesting. So she has a way of coming at the dialogue that never feels real actory, but feels very, very naturalistic. And I really like that.
I'm wondering in this movie, because you're absolutely right with this, like she is the one who has everybody's number. I think that's a good way to put it. And like, I love the moment that I think it's the first time that she and, I was going to say Scott, because of course Scott Pilgrim, are in the car alone together. She and Nick, and she has that thing where she like puts the CD and the, by the way, kids. So back in the day, and this is not even back in the day, but back in the day, you could buy these things from Radio Shack, and it was a cassette tape with a cord, with an auxiliary cord, and you put it in your tape deck, and you could plug your Walkman into your car, and every time you hit a bump, the music would skip. And I love the solution that Nick comes up with, because of course he tapes it to the dashboard, which is what a lot of us did. I put mine in between my emergency brake and the side of the seat. I kept it vertical, and that's how it stayed still and didn't bump. But anyway. There's a moment where she puts the CD in there and she just puts it on and she kind of starts talking to him. And you can tell, like you said, she's kind of going through the motions waiting for him to get to that point of like honesty or vulnerability or like, I need to get through the bullshit first, you know? And then there's that moment where she kind of just like, you know what? Just let me out. Like, this isn't, you know what? Forget it. This isn't working. And it's not like, it's difficult to describe because she has vulnerabilities and she has, you know, that whole subplot about like never really getting close enough to somebody for like sexual pleasure or never getting, you know, only being this one boyfriend. And when she says friends with benefits and he says, what are the benefits? And she's like, yeah, I don't know. That's what I've been trying to figure out. Like little things like that layer her character, but she's putting herself out there with these questions and with these things, but it's not at the expense of like her whole life.
Right.
Again, I think there's the other side to the whole, I just want to hold your hand tonight kind of thing, which is like, yeah, I'm going to go out and try this tonight. And if it doesn't work, like, it's not going to destroy me. Like, it's not the end of the world. I'm still a very intelligent and capable person with a lot of agency. Like, when she's showing him Electric Lady Studios, it's like, yeah, this is part of me too. You know, like this is cool. And I think I like you enough maybe to let you into this part of my life and we'll see how you respond to it. But it's not like, oh my God, please like this and please like me and please, please, please. You know, she's curious about this. She's into it. She's into taking this kind of risk, but it's not the end of the world if it doesn't happen.
Right.
And I think that's a lot of what's really good. Like you said, it's a shame that she gets pitched so much as sarcastic best friend, because what she really is, you know, she just has that, I guess, wisdom to her, or that sort of cagey vulnerability that is, sure, sometimes sarcastic, but also just like hard on your sleeve vulnerable in the same kind of way. But she's just so frigging cool that she's waiting for other people to rise to her level.
What is the... When he's playing the mix and then his voice comes on at the end where he's like, okay, that's our breakup mix or whatever. And she starts to, I can't remember exactly what he says, but I swear he says it's something like, that's not even real. Or like, this isn't even real. I can't remember, but it's such a great, like, attempt at damage control that accomplishes nothing.
That's not even real. They have those. That's not even real. That's not real. That's not a real person. That's not real. Just one last thing. When he says, when she talks about lyrics, when they're at the studio and there's beautiful, like, long lenses, like where she's sitting in the booth and he's sitting in the little studio itself, and they're talking back and forth to each other. And even before that moment, there's that thing where they're talking about music and she describes her favorite lyric and she reads off some verse or whatever. And Nick goes, I wrote that. And there's a moment of familiarity, because I've had that moment where you're like, I wrote that's cool, you know.
Yeah,
like that stood out to you. Oh, that's awesome, you know, like that's that kind of thing. That's so, there's, like you said, there's something very relatable about that, even in a kind of a silly way. But that whole scene is really great. Again, like you said, just the degree of connection that they have and are willing to have.
Yeah.
You know, it as far as it goes. But yeah, I don't know if it's fair to say that Kat Dennings didn't get a fair shake, because obviously she's, you know, very successful. I would like to have seen more of her in a way that, I also want to see her more movies, I guess.
Yeah, it would be nice. I don't know what she's really done since that show, but hopefully they find more good vehicles for her, because, you know, Michael Cera kind of plays this role in his sleep, and he's great at it. And that's why he gets cast in this kind of a part, because it's like, well, this is a Michael Cera role, especially, you know, 9 years ago. We need like a quirky kind of indie band kind of a kid. Oh, Michael Cera, you know, it's Scott Pilgrim. It's whatever. I do really like the movie's relationship to music, or the way it presents these characters and their relationship to music. Cause I don't feel like, even though it's all about, you know, they're playing in a band and they're pursuing this other band and there's constant music playing, I don't feel like it hits you over the head with it. I don't feel like we have characters monologuing about why music is so important to them or what it gives them. It's, again, it's just part of who they are. It's a big part of who they are, and it's the thing that connects the two of them, especially initially, even if Nick doesn't realize it. But and again, I like the sort of matter-of-fact way that it presents that information without having to just constantly sell us on that information.
I wrote down something very similar. I wrote down, there's none of that Garden State bullshit. Which is not like, okay.
Which is just a shot at New Jersey, let's face it.
Well, that's my job as a Philadelphian. Are you ready for this needle drop? Have you ever heard the Shins? Like, here we go. You know, like, and again, I've written about my love for Garden State and I can't escape it. But like, you're so right that it's just a part of it. Like, even when she's driving and she's just flicking through his iPod, and she's just like, you know, you're my musical soulmate or something like that. And it's just like, we did that. Like, we looked through each other's record collections. Right. We looked through each other's iPods. Like, that's what we did. It was like, okay, oh, you like this music? I like this music too. But the music doesn't become the main focus. It's not a test. It's not, there's no, right. Like, it's, yeah, I totally agree. It's not, and that's what makes those moments where he's super douchey about the music stuff, like, really stand out. Because the movie, whereas, like, yeah, again, not to go back to Garden State, but like the scene of Zach Braff letting Natalie Portman listen to the Shins for the first time, and like, you know, he's looking at her with the music and blah, blah, blah. Again, I like that scene, but it is so over your head obnoxious in a way that that movie will continue to, that it'll use that same obnoxiousness over and over. Whereas in Nick and Nora, like, it's just a little moment. It's just a little thing of like, oh, I like this music too, or this and that. So when he gets super douchey, when he gets like, oh, you know, I like to keep the night on my pants, or, you know, oh, I literally, I think that, like, he's just pontificating about music, you know, in a way that, again, I'll freely admit, a lot of us did, I did, to try to impress people. It's not, I don't want to say the movie's not on his side, but for me anyway, I'm with Nora at that point where I'm like, oh my God, he's so obnoxious. Like, let me just put up with this, which is of course what a lot of women have to do, which is let me just put up with this man's obnoxiousness until I get to the root of who he is. But it's not critical. Like you said, it's not saying music is bad. It's just saying, yeah, some people are obnoxious about it, but there is a heart to it. There is a root to it, and you don't have to beat people over the head.
Right. Do you own this soundtrack?
I don't. I have a couple songs from it. I actually was just going to look, but no, I was actually thinking to myself that I should probably buy it.
You really should, because there's like probably at least 3 songs on here that are like all timers, especially again. I have a lot of memories of like driving around, with Erica listening to the soundtrack in our car. And we have a couple songs that, you know, I would like put on CDs for her or make when I would make mixes for her. And, so yeah, there's a handful of the song After Hours, the song Last Words is on there, and then the song, what's the other one? Very Loud is the other one. And those 3 songs are like all-timers.
I know I have After Hours because I have the We Are Scientists record, one of the records, I think. I'm looking at the soundtrack now. Yeah, all right, I'm definitely going to pick it up because I was thinking that when you were describing the Last Words, I was like, ah, oh, you know, I really want to listen to that song again. And that's, I think, the mark of a good, you know, a good soundtrack. It's not in your face about it, but it's, this is a movie that suggests a good, and I was even noticing that like in the marketing, you know, even in the DVD cover where it's all about, you know, every night has a soundtrack and this and that. And, you know, I can see marketing that movie, you know, or I can see that the movie being marketed that way where it's like, oh, it's about kids who are obsessed with music. But so much of the movie isn't about that. You know, it's about real people doing real people things, and music just happens to be the thing that echoes or sort of reinforces it, which is what we should be doing in a situation like this.
Well, and it's a really good mix of songs from bands that I don't necessarily, I mean, I know some of these bands, but I don't know all of them really, really well. Some of them I maybe have only heard of. And you can listen to it completely independently of the movie. And it's just like, well, this is just a good collection of songs. Whereas, again, not to go back to Garden State, but Garden State, almost every song is so intrinsically tied into the movie because each song is used in this like cinematic moment.
Right. It's meant to punctuate a moment.
Exactly. It's always just kind of background.
I wanted to mention real quick, not to get off soundtrack for a second, but the cameos in this movie. So Frankie Faison, Andy Samberg, John Cho, Kevin Corrigan, who's that guy actor whose name I can never remember, is the guy with the turkey sandwich. That's always fun. I like the way they're used. I Ari Grainer, again, I just want to go back to because she is just so incredibly good. And then the sharing the gum motif. I like this time when I was watching it, I was watching the gum go from place to place to place to place, mouth to mouth to mouth in this movie, which is, again, a nice little quirk that didn't have to be there, but it was.
Did you this is a long way to go to make this point. did you ever see the movie Get Over It?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. So I love the movie Get Over It, but it's another movie that, like, there's half a movie I love in there, and then there's half of, like, this nonsense, probably, like, post-American Pie Weinstein bullshit where it's like, we have to have a scene where he goes on a date and something catches on fire, and we have to have a scene where, like, Carmen Electra is stripping or something. There's all this, like, broad comedy bullshit. And none of that stuff's interesting. It's like the really good stuff is the stuff with him and Kirsten Dunst and the Midsummer Night's Dream musical, and all that stuff is gold. Nick and Nora isn't as offensive as that, and there's not as specific a demarcation. But the scene I always think of is like, oh, she throws up and has to get her phone out of the puke toilet. Like, to me, that's the thing that's at odds with the stuff that I really like, which is just the really quiet scenes of two people getting to know each other. It's much more cohesive than something like Get Over It, but watching the train station throw up scene I will give Ari Grainer credit for making some of the best pre-throw up noises I've ever seen in a movie. You were here when we were watching Aliens, and you got to hear Erica screaming during the facehugger scene. It was the exact same reaction. And she's seen Nick and Nora, but I apparently forgot the scene where she has to fish her phone out of the throw up. But the exact same screaming was taking place.
The other to talk for a second about the going too far thing, and this is back to what I was trying to decide whether or not I wanted to bring up with Kat Dennings, is sort of the way she's sometimes sexualized in a way that feels slightly inappropriate. The whole idea of the bra thing, the bra switch out, that felt like one of those steps as well, where I'm like, why are we doing this? Like, I don't want to say it's wrong or bad or that it doesn't, it's not, I just, there's something about it that rubs me the wrong way. And it, I feel like Kat Dennings in this and in Charlie Bartlett, there's kind of that, like, she's kind of the sultry man maker. There's a little bit of that to her where she's like there's something about her sexuality, the way it's designed sometimes in certain roles she's had, where I guess it's because she's, you know, obviously very buxom and very beautiful and stuff, where there's this focus on her sexuality in some ways that it feels a little bit inappropriate. And I thought that whole thing with the bra switch out, like at that point in the movie, she really needs to impress Nick with that. I don't know. That's something that just bothers me a lot. So when you were talking about like little things that go a little bit too far, I think for me, that was one of them.
For me, that scene is offensive more, not as much for how it sexualizes her, but more for, I feel like that's one of those moments where the movie does fall into a little bit of nonsense Hollywood stereotyping with like the gay fairy godmother, which is like, I'm going to show you how to dress because I'm gay and we're all ladies here. Okay, great. You know, way to turn this into a stereotype. But I'm with you.
Yeah, just a little bit too much there. But yeah, overall, you know, I don't know. I don't know what it is. Again, we talked about the kind of the structural stuff. But is there, aside from just the weakness of the characters, do you think that there are, like, are there moments that you would really take out of this or rearrange, like, from a structural perspective? Like, I really don't like this, or this?
I wish there was just a little more. I wish it just made a little more sense sometimes in terms of, now we have to go here, or now I'm in the car with this person, as opposed to just, it's this weird like game of musical chairs at times. And some of that is probably by design. And I know that, like, because the movie wants to be this sort of young romance, in addition to being a One Crazy Night movie, some of the One Crazy Night stuff just is way less interesting to me. And that's where a lot of like the cameos come in and that kind of stuff. Which, whatever, they're fine. It's a movie that, like, I think we've done a valiant job of trying to talk about what makes it special. I don't think I could ever convince anyone that it's good if they didn't think that it was good. I couldn't say, like, no, here's why. I can't on paper explain to someone why it's good. I think you either lead with your heart on this movie or it leaves you cold, which I completely understand. I'm glad that you and I both kind of lead with our heart on it.
As we always do.
Anything else you want to add?
No, not specifically. Just that I love this movie and it was fun to talk about.
It was fun to talk about. We did a better job than I was even expecting. Way to go, us. Oh, very nice. Very nice.
It's right where my mind went.
Anyway, thank you. This was fun. And I like that, you know, sometimes we can do movies like this where hopefully somebody will now give it a chance that wasn't already going to, and hopefully they'll really like it.
I think this is our groove, Patrick. This is our sweet spot. These like weird, like quirky exploding heart movies. I think that's where you and I are going to have our best shows.
So like this and Death to Smoochie, you think?
The podcast that no one asked for.
I stand by our Death to Smoochie show.
Why?
It would have been much more popular had anyone seen the movie Death to Smoochie.
It would have been much more popular had Bobcat Goldthwait directed it.
Right? Damn it. Anyway, thank you guys all for listening. Remember to visit fthismovie.com every day and follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. We're on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube, although we don't often have videos going up, so I can't tell you to subscribe to us there. But we got stuff going on all the time. We don't have another big event, you know, post F This Movie Fest until June, which is probably going to come up a lot sooner than I realize.
Yes, it will. It's going to be here fast.
My goodness. Anyway, thanks again, Rob. This was really fun.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.